Well, I'll pick up where we left off last week. On 13th of July in 1813, a small Portuguese vessel sailed up the Irrawaddy River in Rangoon. You can see the river Irrawaddy on the map there, and you can see, I hope, Burma with its capital city of Aba, and Rangoon is right down at the estuary of the Irrawaddy, where it enters the Indian Ocean. And there this little vessel arrived with two passengers, a young American couple, Adoniram and Anne Judson, ages 25 and 24 respectively. The missionaries were bringing the gospel to Burma for the first time. Now, I thought a verse that would really be suitable for this evening is that little quotation from the Psalms. They that sow in tears shall reap in joy. He that goeth forth weeping, bearing precious seed, shall doubtless come again with rejoicing, bringing his sheaves with him. That was certainly going to be evident in what we think of tonight. Now, Burma then was a totally unknown land, a very large country, stretching from China to the Indian Ocean, as large as France, Belgium, and Holland put together. It had a population twice that of North America of that time, population of 27 million, half of it forested, very valuable forests, hardwoods, teak, and woods like that. It was totally shut off from the rest of the world. Its old civilization had never contemplated anything outside its own boundaries. Apart from a handful of Europeans, there wasn't a white resident there. In religion, it was 100% Buddhist. Conversion to any faith meant instant death. Christianity was totally unknown. There wasn't one Christian church, one Bible, one Christian book, and not one Burmese Christian in the land. Government was astonishingly cruel, corrupt, ruled over a king as despotic as somebody like Nebuchadnezzar, with the power of life or death. The royal city was Aba. You can see it up there. Mandalay has virtually replaced it now. Mandalay was built in the 1850s. But Aba was the ancient capital, where the dynasty of the present king stretched back several centuries. The Irrawaddy River was the main highway, and Aba was nearly 400 miles up the river from the sea. The climate was deadly for Europeans. It would be normal for them to die early. So you can see it was no wonder that everybody the Judsons had met, their friends in India, William Carey, all the other believers, had begged them not to think of Burma, and they had given up the idea. And then last week we saw, by a series of amazing providences, how God led them irresistibly finally to arrive in Burma. And that's where we begin tonight. Now, it was a very depressing sight when they got there. It was evening, and we saw last week that everything looked gloomy, dismal, very, very discouraging. Next morning, when they stepped ashore, things looked a bit brighter. They found the Burmese a very friendly people and a very curious people. Anne was being carried on a kind of a litter. The Burmese women thronged around her. They wanted to touch her, look at her, and so on. And they were thrilled when she smiled at them and laughed and so on. So they felt a little bit better. They noticed that none of the children wore any clothes to the age of about seven. Everybody smoked cigars, right down to little babies. It was an astonishing country. The women chewed a kind of root that turned their teeth black and left a dripping saliva from their mouths. That seemed to be the normal thing. It was a strange country to go to. It was rich in natural resources, but very, very poor as a land. Food was dear, the poor starved, robbery and murder were common. Personal honesty was unknown. They were a nation of liars. They assumed everybody else lied. Truth was unknown. Bribery was normal. And so they arrived in Rangoon. They knew not one word of Burmese. Nobody in Rangoon knew one word of English. Clearly, the first thing they must do would be to able to communicate. A little French was known in Rangoon, so they began by learning enough French to get by while they could set about trying to learn Burmese. Now, how they were to do that, they didn't know, but they did, I suppose, the obvious thing. They hired a teacher, an old Hindu scholar, a Burman, and they asked him to come to the place where they were lodging to teach them Burmese. Well, it was quite an amusing beginning. The three of them sat down, the teacher, Adoniram, and Anne. They looked at each other. None of them could speak a word that the others understood. Where on earth could they begin? So Adoniram began the only way he could think of. So he pointed to something in the room, a familiar object, and the teacher got the idea and gave him a word. And so they repeated that word till they learned the name for that particular object. And so they went on, not like learning languages at school. That's the only way they could go about it. And this they did 12 hours a day, day after day, until they could get a little knowledge of the Burmese language. The first one to be able to speak it was Anne, because she had to keep house, she had to buy in the market, she had to talk to the women, and she was, of course, a clever woman, and very soon she could converse with the Burmese women. Adoniram was slower, but he was learning the grammar. Now, the problem was the writing. I think we've got one there, haven't we, Phil? That is Burmese script. It is unlike anything they had ever seen before. Long series of circles and loops, written on palm leaves, working from right to left. No punctuation, no sentence, nor paragraph divisions. Everything ran together. Even there were no capital letters. They wondered, would they ever succeed in being able to read the language and never mind write it? But they persevered. And as they learned Burmese, they tried to use it. Both had the gift of making friendships, and at every possible occasion, they used contacts to evangelize. They soon realized that much would depend on the favor of the viceroy. Burma, the Rangoon, was, if you like, ruled by a deputy from the king, the viceroy. So Adoniram thought it would be a good thing for him to call on the viceroy. Well, it was a failure. The viceroy was important, self-important. He would hardly look at him. So Anne thought she would have a try, and she would call on his wife. Well, he had about 30 wives, but she called on the principal wife. She was charmed. Anne was actually a very, very striking woman, very beautiful, with an outgoing personality, and the lady was charmed. And many questions. Was she Adoniram's chief wife? Did she have any children, and so on? And just then the viceroy came in, and Anne was terrified. She had never seen such a fearsome-looking character. A long robe, an enormous spear which he never put down. Wherever he went, he had this enormous spear. But he was impressed. He said to Anne, "You must come again." And so a friendship began that lasted until his death, actually. And when their little boy was born, he was, even the viceroy was softened, as his wife pointed out to him what a child she was, a white skin. There had never been a white child born in Rangoon before. And he was very impressed, and the little boy became a favorite. Soon he was often invited to the palace, but he died. Again, sewing in tears was going to be their experience. This was her second child who died, and it did break her heart. And the kind viceroy's wife, seeing this, to cheer her, invited her to a picnic. Never been to such a picnic before. Began with an elephant calling at the house for them, and then they were joined by a procession of two more elephants in front, 30 men with guns, 3 or 4 elephants behind for the family and court officials, 200 to 300 retainers, and so the picnic began. It was a 3 or 4 hour ramble into the jungle to a secluded garden hidden away, a beautiful place where Her Highness waited on Anne personally, doing everything she could to show kindness to her. It was very kind, and they were pleased, but for all the efforts they made, they could not make any impression with the gospel. She would speak to the women, and they would say, "Yes, your religion is good. It's good for you. Ours is good for us. You will be rewarded in your way. We will be rewarded in ours." The men would listen to Adonai impolitely, impassively. "Yes," they said, "it is good, but our minds are very stiff. They cannot change." And so, in that sense, it was disappointing. But they won many, many friends in Rangoon. They persevered for the next few years. Now, we can look back and we see what followed. They couldn't. They couldn't look forward. For them, it seemed a hopeless prospect. He was working all day translating. Anne was housekeeping, working among the women, holding a school for 20 or 30 children. In the evenings, they would mingle with their Burmese friends, talking whenever they could of the gospel. But it was sewing. No more. And they realized that the greatest need of that land was a Bible in Burmese. Well, an encouragement came. In 1816, 3 years after they were there, a colleague arrived from America. He was a printer. He had a printing press. And now he could print faster than Adoniram could translate. But long before he understood the language, he had learned to set the type and print it. So he was printing before he understood what he was printing. They were working on the Gospel of Matthew. But Adoniram wrote a tract, a 7-page tract, explaining the Gospel, and 1,000 copies were distributed. Anne prepared a catechism for children, and that was printed. I think we can finish with that one now, Phil. I think that's Anne's catechism, actually. But it was slow, patient work. And the work went on like that, just sowing a seed. They couldn't do anything more. The tract was called The Way to Heaven. It was distributed. They wondered, had it had any effect? Meanwhile, two other young couples came out, and soon there was sorrow again. They both fell desperately ill. In fact, the one died, and his wife became mentally unhinged and went to India. But the other stayed. He recovered. A young man called Coleman, in his early 20s, proved to be a brilliant linguist and a faithful colleague until he, too, died well under 30. But it was a cheer to the Judsons. So sorrow followed. Already 2 children were dead. Already colleagues were dead. The threat of persecution was always there, particularly when their friend the viceroy was moved to Arva and a new one came, and he was not at all friendly. and soon they noticed that people were afraid to come and visit them. And somehow God used this, because Adoniram said to himself, well, if they won't come to visit me, I must find a way of going to them. What he did was, he built what was known as a zayat. Now, I don't know the pronunciation of Burmese, so I'm going to pronounce the words as they are in English, Z-A-Y-A-T. But these were kind of rest houses by the highway, a veranda and a room at the back, about 30 foot by 20, that kind of thing, on wood, on stilts. All Burmese houses were in Rangoon were on stilts. And there passers-by could call in and rest, and there the Buddhist priests would teach them. Adoniram said he would build his own zayat. He did. Bought a plot of land on the main highway to the great pagoda, the greatest pagoda in the whole land that dominated Rangoon. And thronged with pilgrims going to and fro, there was that zayat. And there was Adoniram in the veranda calling out to people, "Ho, everyone who is thirsting for knowledge," using a Bible verse in a new way. And callers would look in. Many would stay. Some would just listen for a short while and go. But still there was no serious listening. It tended to be very, very superficial. And then suddenly encouragement came, totally unexpectedly, in 1817, 4 years after they'd been there. The festival was at its height. Rangoon was packed. And a gentleman and his servant came to the zayat. After the usual polite greetings, he asked the question, "How long will it take me to learn the religion of Jesus?" Adoniram was stunned. "Who is he?" he said. "Oh," said the gentleman, "he is the Son of God who, pitying human creatures, came into this world and suffered in their place. And who is God? He is a being without beginning and end, not subject to old age or change or death. He always is." Adoniram knew where he'd learned that. He'd had one of his tracts. And it was a beginning of an inquiry. It was such a cheer. Only the first pages of Matthew had been printed. He let them have those. He let them have another copy of another tract. And the gentleman went away. But he never came back. Their disappointment was all the greater because of the hopes they had built up. And so it went on, just sowing, no result. Burmese, polite, impassive, but no change. They must just go on sowing. Now, I think you and I know that experience in our day, don't we? But Adoniram was convinced that time would bring a harvest. Well, after 6 years of sowing, a tiny beginning was seen. Among those who called at the zayat, they noticed one poor man. Unlike the others who came and went, who never listened, he came and came and came. Just a poor labourer, and he drank in the gospel. And at last, in June of 1819, very shyly he asked, could he be baptized? And on questioning him, he was undoubtedly a believer. He was baptized. There was a lily pool in the shadow of the great pagoda, with the statue of Buddha looking down on it, and there in that lily pool, the first believer in Burma was baptized, to the astonishment of a crowd of Burmese onlookers. Well, it was a wonderful thing, and soon he was joined by two other poor working men, and then by a third, this time a scholar. And so a little church began in Rangoon, first church in Burma, just a handful. At once Judson started what became the feature of Burmese church life. He started a prayer meeting, and from then on, that the history of that church was founded, if you like, on the prayer meetings. That's good for us, isn't it? It is how we began and how we trust we will ever continue. Well, they needed encouragement. There was crisis in the air. Nobody knew what was happening. The Zayat was deserted. Nobody came. Nobody listened. The viceroy left for Arba. The city was confused. And then an announcement came. The old king was dead. His grandson reigned, and all was quiet again. It had causes behind the quietness. The accession of the grandson wasn't just like that. It involved the murder of the whole royal family, brothers, children, grandchildren, sewn in red sacks, thrown into the river Irrawaddy and drowned. The uncle was murdered. 1,400 of the upper classes died, and between 10 and 15,000 commoners. And the king got his throne. That was Burma. Well, Adoniram saw danger ahead for the infant church. With a king like that, and in Rangoon, the Buddhist priests were waking up to what he was doing. There was opposition stirring. He saw that the infant church was threatened, and he made a very brave decision. He and Coleman would go to Arba and present a petition to the new king. He was a youngish man, only 30 years old, and ask for permission, or toleration, if you like, for the work they were doing. Well, it was a brave decision. Nearly 400 miles up the river, as they went up progressively, the attitudes hardened, opposition could be felt, Buddhism was stronger, till finally they got to the Golden City, an ancient city of tremendous wealth and beauty. The king was obviously supreme, a dictator just like Nebuchadnezzar. Access was difficult, but they had an introduction. Their old friend, the first viceroy, was living there, and with their introduction, they had access, and they had a present. You couldn't give anything to a man of such enormous wealth, but they brought an English Bible, a magnificent Bible, gold plate covering the covers in 6 volumes as a present for the king. They entered the magnificent hall, domed roof supporting by hundreds of tall pillars, all gold-covered, right down to the floor, which was gold-covered, and they waited among the crowd seeking audience. And then the golden feet, as the king was called, approached. Everybody fell flat on their faces. They too knelt, and they caught the king's eye. Who are these? The teachers, great king, replied Adoniram. The king was surprised. You speak Burmese. Some questions followed. They handed in the petition and Judson's tract. The king read the petition. He read the first sentence of the tract, flung it on the floor and walked on, but Judson knew he was rejected. They were very downcast as they returned down to Arva downriver. To be rejected was worse than they'd never been, and they wondered what would follow. They gathered the little church together. Should they leave, they asked them, for the safety of the native believers, but they wouldn't hear of it. No, they said, this gospel must spread. The king can't stop it. Though persecution lies before us, hell also lies before us. Anybody who fears hell can never help receiving the gospel. No, you mustn't go in it. If you did, and people are converted, who will baptize them? We can't baptize. And the greater the danger, the bolder the disciples came. It was an amazing thing. They began openly evangelizing, and soon converts were coming, and the next year the first woman to be converted in Burma came. "Set me down for a disciple," she said. "I'm afraid I'm not ready to be baptized yet, but put me down for a disciple, I believe." She did believe. She lived a lovely Christian life and died rejoicing later on. And so there was another baptism. They were urgent. They couldn't wait. And they were baptized, including the woman. They did it by lantern light because she was very nervous. So they did it by lantern light, again in a pool along by the highway. And now there was a church of 10 believers. And so they had to go away and needed urgent medical treatment in India. And she and Adoniram went for 2 months. And when they came back, they were delighted with what they saw. The church thriving, the gospel being preached, and a new viceroy, their old friend, the spear carrier that they'd met at the first. This was cheering. And so they began to take hope. And now Adoniram felt he was free to concentrate on his chief work, translation. After Matthew followed Ephesians, and then all the Gospels, Acts, Romans, and Burma was on its way to having a Bible. Well, now, in 1822, providentially something happened. A young couple from America joined them at Dr. Jonathan Price, an unusual man, actually, tall and gangling and untidy and disorganized, quite a character, a tremendous talker. Long before he knew Burmese, he was talking to Burmans. They were fascinated. They couldn't understand a word he said. But he was a talker. But he did learn quickly and was a great power as a witness. But he was a skilled doctor. And he was especially skilled in cataracts. And that in Burma was something that was vital. It became a fame that spread to the royal city of Arbor. And in July 1922, a royal command came for him to attend the court at Arbor at government expense. And Adoniram saw God's hand here, where he couldn't get in before. This was a door opening. He went with him. But not before he had baptized his 18th convert. At this time, Anne was in America for 2 years, again medical treatment not available in India. This time the king was quite affable. His throne was secure by now, he had no anxieties, and he had much to ask Dr. Price, and then he noticed Adoniram. He didn't recognize him from the last time. "Oh, and you in black, are you a medical man?" "No, Your Majesty, I am a teacher of religion." After a few casual questions, the king asked rather sharply, "Have any embraced your religion?" "Not here in Arbor, but in Rangoon, a few." "Foreigners?" "Some foreigners, some Burmese." There was silence, and Judson waited for the king's wrath to burst out, but instead he changed the subject, asked him about astronomy and geography. Well, Adoniram was actually a very, very learned, if I can use the word, person. He was totally at home here, and his answers on astronomy actually brought murmurs of approval from the assembled court, and the king was very impressed. But he went back to his first question. "These Burmese converts, are they real Burmese?" "Yes." "Do they dress like Burmese?" "Yes, and I preach them in Burmese every Sunday." "In Burmese," said the king. "Well, then let me hear you." And so, in front of the assembled court, the gospel was preached. He began with the being of God and the command of the gospel, and then he stopped. But one of the privy councillors said, "Go on." And he did go on. And finally the king said, "But what about Buddha?" Now, he was very wise and careful. Choosing his words, "We regard him as a wise man and a great teacher, but not as God." After the interview, the king made his decision. Dr. Price must stay. He would build him a house adjoining the palace. And Adoniram may, if he wishes, obtain housing and stay, if he wants to bring his wife up to join him. But Dr. Price's servants are urgently needed, and he must stay. So Adoniram went back. He realized that perhaps by moving there, the disciples, the believers at Rangoon, would be safer, and he could have more influence in the toleration of the gospel in Burma. So he had a house built in readiness, very simple, by the river, again on stilts, a veranda, three rooms, and he prepared for life at Arva. Not as pleasant as it sounded, temperatures of 108 plus, not very easy for a European. So when Anne came back in 1823, they moved their home to their new location. Well, now a new work was before them, and the future looked promising. Adoniram was still translating, preaching on Sundays in Dr. Price's house to about 20 people. Anne was winning friends among the women. She made friends with the king's sister. She had a little school of 20 or so children. And things looked hopeful, but suddenly everything changed. War broke out. The Burmese were a very aggressive, warlike nation. They had plans to annex East Bengal. That's the part of India nearest to the Burmese border. They had gathered an army of about 30,000 people to invade. The British got wind of it, and they decided to act first. So, ignoring the army on the border, the fleet went to Rangoon, which fell almost immediately, and the British occupied Rangoon. The Burmese were furious. They had a contempt for everything foreign, and what was this little island far away across the sea doing to attack such an ancient nation as Burma? They were totally ignorant of everything except things Burmese. But questions were asked. Who told the British that we were doing this? There must be spies in Arva. Who could they be? It must be the foreigners. And so it happened. Adoniram was busy with translation one day when suddenly he was confronted by the most feared people in Burma. They were called the Spotted Faces. They were actually convicted murderers released to become the king's executioners, and their faces were all tattooed. Where is the teacher? You are called for by the king. And protested, we're Americans, we're not English. It was of no avail. He was dragged away bound and taken to the place they called Death Prison, where he found Dr. Price and all other Europeans. There were a handful in Arva. While he was gone, Anne at once very wisely burned everything, letters, journals, papers, everything that might be incriminating, and buried most of the valuables. They didn't have many in the garden, and particularly the manuscripts of the New Testament in a sealed bag, buried for safety. The next 19 months was a heart-rending story. It's impossible to go into it. It was rightly called Death Prison. One room of 30 by 40 feet. No window, small door, and 50 prisoners, including some dying and some women. No food, except what relatives brought. And Adoniram had to endure the torture of heavy chains. For the first 2 months, five pairs of these heavy iron chains. For the next 9 months, three pairs, and for the last 6 months, one pair. It was torture. but Anne now appeared at her greatest. She was pregnant, but in the heat, the unbearable heat, every day she came to the prison with food for Adoniram and Dr. Price and others. Then she worked tirelessly, lobbying everybody she knew in Arva, visiting every one of the ladies, and pleading that they were not involved. They were Americans. This was not their quarrel. It didn't have any effect, but she was very hard to resist. An astonishingly beautiful woman of charm and dignity in Burmese dress. Even the city governor wept as he had to tell her he couldn't release them, but he promised he would never order their death. She won access to the prison by gifts to the guards. She obtained their removal from this horrible cell to an open shed, if you like, in the courtyard of the prison. It broke her heart to see her husband. He was a man scrupulously neat and clean and tidy. To see him covered with filth and lice so as to be unrecognizable was heartbreaking. And it went on like that. By now she had a little baby girl. She was often too weak to feed her, had to beg help from nursing mothers in the village. But she never failed them. The whole of that period, apart from the 20 days of her confinement, she was at the prison every day. Fearing for the safety of the New Testament, she sewed it in a rough goat's hair pillow, so rough that nobody would want to steal it. And there she gave it to Adoniram as his pillow, and so the most precious thing they had was safe until it was all over. It had to come, the end had to come. The Burmese were brave, but they were totally ignorant of modern warfare. Huge armies of 30, 40, 60,000 people were of no avail against British gunboats and cannon, and they were driven back up the river Irrawaddy until finally Arva itself was under threat. The Burmese had no idea of treaties or promises. They made promises and at once broke them, until British patience was exhausted and an ultimatum was given. You surrender, or Arva will be sacked and there'll be no guarantee of safety for the royal family. And that, of course, led to a surrender. Adoniram and Dr. Price and all British prisoners must be instantly released, and they were free. But it was nearly between a year and a half and 2 years. Adoniram was unrecognizable, and Anne was worn, not to a skeleton, but she was worn to be on the edge of a serious illness. The negotiations took place. The finale was a magnificent banquet in the British camp, carefully stage-managed to impress the Oriental mind. Regimental band, all the banners, everything, pomp and ceremony, everything you could think of, so that the Burmese delegates were overawed by the greatness of the British. And there, at the head of the chief table, were Adoniram and Anne Judson. When the Burmese negotiators saw them, they trembled. These were the people they had so fearfully mistreated and insulted. Surely this was a time of revenge. They did literally tremble. One man could hardly sit at the table, he was so terrified. Anne saw it, and very kindly in Burmese she said, "You have nothing to fear." Well, the treaty was signed and settled, and the issue was over. At that time, a writer said, "Anne Judson must be one of the most remarkable women of her age. The only European woman in Arva, she spent the whole time caring for the prisoners. She carried with her a presence that commanded respect from even the most savage of the Burmese, and encircled with a moral atmosphere, she walked unharmed, with no human protection, in a hostile city. Everywhere she was known as the guardian angel of the prisoners. Her work if that was all she had done, was tremendous. Well, the war was over now, 1826. The treaty left Rangoon and northern Burma in Burmese hands, and the coastal strip to the south, which you can see beginning with the word Thailand, the thin, narrow strip at the south became British territory. And there a new centre was set up at Amherst, which you can see on the map, and the British made that their base. The Judsons moved there. They realized that they would make no progress in Rangoon, particularly as the Burmese associated the Judsons with the British Army. The little church had been scattered by the war. What few they were moved with them. Adoniram's help was needed. The authorities needed translators. He knew more of Burmese than any other living European. And so Anne determined that she would remain at Amherst and with her little baby daughter, and he would go up to Ava to translate for the making of a treaty. She and he both agreed he would never leave his work and become a government servant. Actually, Dr. Price and the printer both did. Unknown to him, while he was away, Anne fell victim to what we would now think of as cerebral meningitis and was at death's door, and little Maria was sickly. He was unaware of that. The ordeals of the prison period had finally left their mark. One day a letter came to Arva with a black seal. He opened it. He felt sure it was the news that his little girl had died. He was utterly unready to read the brief message. Mrs. Judson is dead. She died on the 24th of October. The baby lingered on till the following April. And now all his earthly ties were gone, buried in Burmese soil, his wife and three children. He had indeed sown in tears. Her last wish, which she asked to be given to him, was that he would never give up his work, he would never enter government service. To add to his sorrows, his friend Coleman, only 27, died too, and it wasn't long before he heard that Jonathan Price, the doctor, had died. Yes, it was sowing in sorrow. Anne's death was something he had never, never dreamed of. His grief was unbearable. To him it was inexplicable. For the only time in his life, despair overwhelmed him. For a month, everything was total black depression. He was almost crushed. He tried escape and solitude to meditate. It was made it far, far worse. His faithful converts actually watched over him and fed him and finally persuaded him to get back, and he began to realize that there was only one remedy for his sorrow, his work. So he began again. He didn't realize that his best work lay ahead. He was working as somebody who thought he had little time left. He longed to be in heaven with his wife. In fact, he had 24 more years. His work was obvious. The New Testament was now in print, and a third of the Old Testament. His vision was a Burmese Bible. He'd seen so many missionaries come and go, most by early death, and he saw the Bible as a kind of missionary who never leaves, is never ill, who never changes. And his longing was a Burmese Bible in every village. With the Bible went gospel tracts. He regarded those as preachers who could enter where nobody else could, where doors were closed. And now he was beginning to reap from his sowing. They had moved from Amherst to Moulmein, which was a healthier spot. The whole British administration had moved for health reasons, town of about 30,000 people, just higher up the coast. And there the work flourished. He had published his tract, and then at the festival at Moulmein, 10,000 tracts were given away in a short period only to people who came and inquired. In fact, over 6,000 people called at his house to ask for a tract. And results came, letters came. A letter came later from the border of Siam and China. "We hear there's an eternal hell. We are afraid of it. Give us a writing to tell us how to escape." A letter came from Cathay, 100 miles north of Arbor. "Sir, we hear there's an eternal God. Are you the writer of that that we read? If so, give us a writing. We want to know the truth before we die." Another came. "Are you Jesus Christ's man? Give us a writing that will tell us about Jesus Christ. Give us a writing." And he knew where his work lay. Apart from writing, he built a zayat in the poorest part of the town, and every day he taught there. Inquiries increased. The work spread, and he had good news from Rangoon. The believers were back. The church was flourishing. They were standing firm. But it was in the south where the British ruled that the greatest blessing came. Baptisms multiplied. In the years before the war, 18. In the year immediately following, up to 1832, 217. In the next years, 353. In 1836, 1144. Reaping. Sowing continuing, reaping. And now his hands were full. Translating, preaching, teaching, pastoring. As a pastor, perhaps he excelled. The Burmese said he knew us better than we knew ourselves. If we saw saw something amiss, he would send for us and talk us kindly, and suddenly, before we knew it, he put his finger on us and held us till we confessed everything. Yes, he was a pastor. Well, happy years followed. He was alone, yes, but he saw fruit. Now, it so happened that in the wild mountain jungles of the southern part of Burma, there was a nomadic people called the Karens. They were rarely seen. They were untamable, like wild animals, and ungovernable. And two young missionaries had gone to work among them. He sent a convert to join them. Many were saved and baptized. And then the husband died, tragically. His widow stayed on, Sarah Boardman. She refused to go back. She continued in the mountains with her four-year-old little boy, carried by a native Karen, preaching, climbing mountains, crossing rivers, a heroic lady. Judson admired her. And ultimately, when she'd been widowed for 3 years, they married. And for the next years, she was a tremendous help. She was very able as a linguist. The Burmese Bible was completed, then a dictionary for the future missionaries. And her contributions also included bringing him a home for the next 11 years, happiness in the family. Well, we can't go on any further. He did go back because Sarah died. He went with her. She died on the way and was buried in St. Helena. The States he didn't like. He didn't want fame. He found himself a celebrity. All over America, hundreds and hundreds of little boys were being called Adoniram. He longed to be back to where he was at home, Burma. And as soon as possible, he did go back. Rangoon, but then back to Moulmein. Well, worn out, he took a sea voyage, the only known cure then for what we now call TB, but then it was consumption. Nothing improved, and he was buried at sea, 1850. When he landed in Burma, there was no gospel, no Bible, not one believer, no Burmese church. When he died, Burma had a Bible, a church, practicing baptism by immersion with thousands of baptized members. He had proved the power of the Word of God, a seed with life in itself. He had indeed put his hand to the plow and never turned back. He had indeed gone forth weeping, bearing precious seed, and now he was home in heaven rejoicing, bringing many sheaves with him. Lives like that, I think, come as a little challenge to us, don't they? Perhaps a rebuke in our comfortable age. But they also come as an encouragement when we sometimes get cast down by our discouragements. They that sow in tears shall reap in joy. Still true. In due season we too shall reap if we faint not. Now is the time for sowing. We must go on sowing. God in his time will send the reaping. Now we'll sing a hymn in closing. For All the Saints, 793. To us, Lord, in our day, the same faithfulness as thy servants of old. For thy mercies in ever saving us, we praise thee gratefully, and we desire that all of us, in some little measure, may be able to repay thy grace to us by loyal service to thee. Bless us now as we separate with our praise and our thanksgiving in the name of our Lord Jesus Christ. Amen.